Good evening. I'd like to welcome you all, and many of you to welcome you again into this space, to the Burks Lectures for 2013. Our new principal and vice chancellor, Suzanne Fortier, has very graciously agreed to introduce the lectures this year. And without further ado, I'll ask Suzanne to come to the podium, Madam Principal.
Voilà. Merci, Ellen. Bonsoir et bienvenue à vous tous. Merci d'être parmi nous ce soir pour cette présentation qui, je suis sûre, va être très intéressante. En fait, j'ai entendu le son des cloches avec beaucoup de plaisir parce qu'on a tous très hâte d'écouter le professeur Ferguson. Ladies and gentlemen, honored guests, distinguished colleagues, students, Professor Ferguson and Margaret Ferguson. Thank you for joining us this evening at the first of two lectures in the 2013 Burks Lecture Series. This year, we celebrate the 63rd year since the annual Burks Lecture Series was established. It is also the 65th anniversary of the Faculty of Religious Study, which was brought into being, as some of you have already heard at the reception, through the generosity of the late William Massey Burks, who nurtured a passion for the study of theology in innovative and transformative ways. His passion and vision guided the formation of the Ecumenical Consortium of the Theological Colleges in Montreal in 1912, the first such association in North America. He was chairman of the joint board of the colleges, where this beautiful building, the William and Henry Burks building, was constructed and donated to the university in 1931. And it was his conversations with McGill's then principal, Cyril James, that served as the catalyst for the 1948 founding of the university's Faculty of Divinity, which was later renamed the Faculty of Religious Studies. So as you can see, we are very fortunate that the Burks family has chosen to act as a catalyst for us, not only once, but many, many times. Since its inception in 1950, the Burks Lecture Series has explored the diverse facets of the world's religions, their histories, their expressions, and their local and global interactions. This prestigious annual lecture series that has featured such renowned thinkers as Huston Smith, Northrop Frye, Wilfred Cantwell Smith, Christopher Standall, Harvey Cox, and David Little has helped to enhance faculty's reputation as an important center for the study of global religions. Many of you here tonight who are or have been graduate students in the faculty have held Burks Fellowships or won Burks Prize. Alors, félicitations à vous tous qui avez été dans le passé des récipiendaires de ces bourses et de ces honneurs de la famille Burks. So I want to take this opportunity to honor the memory, the vision, and the passion of William Massey Burks and the Burks family, and to express on behalf of the faculty and the university our gratitude for gifts that in so many ways have strengthened and enriched the faculty's work. The Burks family continues to support the faculty in significant ways, and a little earlier this afternoon, we came together to recognize and thank them for their latest gift, which is directed towards the creation of the Burks Forum on the World's Religions and Public Policy, a timely and important initiative. How wonderful to have here with us this evening the great-grandson of William Massey Burks, Jonathan Burks, who is a dear friend of the faculty and co-chair of the Faculty Advisory Board. Please join me in welcoming him and his wife, Maria. Jonathan et Maria, j'aimerais vous remercier très sincèrement pour votre appui et puis votre amitié à cette belle faculté et à notre université. Merci énormément. And now Dean Aitken will introduce our distinguished speaker.
Thank you, Madam Principal. David Ferguson. David, I hope you don't feel like you've come to another family's wedding in all of this. But we are delighted to have you and Margot among us. So it's my pleasure to introduce to you Professor David Ferguson and to welcome his wife, Margot Ferguson. Professor Ferguson is Principal of New College in the University of Edinburgh, where he is also Professor of Divinity. Trained in philosophy and theology, David Ferguson worked for many years as a parish minister in the Church of Scotland, prior to returning to Edinburgh, where he held a lectureship from 1986. He was professor of systematic theology in the University of Aberdeen from 1990 to the year 2000. He has delivered the Bampton Lectures in Oxford, the Gifford Lectures in Glasgow, the Warfield Lectures in Princeton, and has lectured widely in the USA, Europe, Hong Kong, Japan, Korea, and Australia. And later this year, he will also give the Holcim Sermon at the University of Cambridge. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh and a fellow of the British Academy. He holds numerous research grants, including one for the development of a new Master of Science program in science and religion, grants from the Arts and Humanities Research Council of Great Britain, talking therapy using readers' theatre to dialogue about counselling, understanding the encounter between Christianity, psychotherapy, and spirituality in Scotland in theory and practice, and a project on theological curriculum development. Some of us may ask you about that over dinner for local needs. His publications include Church, State, and Civil Society in 2004, The Blackwell Companion to 19th Century Theology in 2010, Community, Liberalism, and Christian Ethics, 1998, Faith and Its Critics, A Conversation, and also John McMurray, Critical Perspectives. And I think we may, over the course of your visit here, explore the ways in which John McMurray's thought has also been influential in the thought around this faculty over the decades, as well as he's published innumerable articles and essays. So, David, we are privileged to have you here as the 2013 Birx Lecturer for two lectures on the Theology of Providence, Perspectives and Problems. Tonight, Providence in Christian Tradition, Theoretical and Practical Challenges. And tomorrow, at the same time, same place, Re-envisioning Providence Today. Tonight's lecture will be followed by a question and answer period, which will be moderated by my colleague, Professor Douglas Farrow, and also by a wine and cheese reception downstairs, to which you are all most warmly invited. Professor Ferguson.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Principal Fortier, Dean Aitken, members of the Birx family, colleagues in the Faculty of Religious Studies, ladies and gentlemen, my sincere thanks for your welcome to this distinguished university and its faculty. It's an honour to be here to deliver the Birx Lectures, not least given the distinguished succession of previous speakers in this series. And I'm glad, too, to renew in a small way the long-standing links between Scotland and McGill. Your founder, James McGill, and I were both born in Glasgow and attended the university there, although he was 200 years ahead of me and led a much more adventurous life. But his legacy and that of others ensured that later generations like mine could enjoy a more extensive education than his own circumstances had permitted. My theme today and tomorrow is the theology of providence. Providence is a term that was much more in vogue in the 19th century than it is now, but my claim will be that it remains a central and persistent theological theme in the Christian tradition and in the spiritual life of Christian people. I say theme since I do not regard providence as a discrete doctrine, so much as an aspect of every doctrine. For this reason, I believe that its treatment has suffered in the past by being handled in many of the textbooks as a subdivision of the doctrine of creation. Yet it seems that all of God's works, according to the Christian tradition, must have a providential character, and not simply those that can be treated under the first article on God the Creator. Those who instead regarded providence as a necessary attribute of God were right, at least in that one respect. The theology of providence has also suffered from the lack of an outstanding dedicated treatise in the history of the tradition. In dealing with other themes, we can usually point students to a locus classicus. One thinks of Athanasius on the Incarnation, Gregory Nazianzus on the Holy Spirit, Anselm on the Atonement, Aquinas, perhaps, on the Eucharist, Luther on justification, and so on. But where does one find a seminal statement on divine providence? One option might be John Calvin in Book One of the Institutes, but the effect of this on students is usually to provide them with a treatment of providence which they instinctively reject. Interpreting this only in negative terms, and thus providing a good example of the danger of interpreting classical texts too aggressively. When I read 50 exam answers on Calvin on Providence in the merry month of May, I might be fortunate to find one or two which are sympathetic, although this year the number was even less. The comprehensive significance of providence is evidenced by its biblical, its socio-political, scientific, apologetic, and existential dimensions. These combined make it impossible to discard notions of providence. If the concept did not exist, we would have to invent something like it. So let me characterize each of these elements very briefly. At first, Scripture. The term providence does not itself feature much in Scripture, although we begin to see some emergence of the term in the deuterocanonical works written in Greek. The nearest we come to a standard reference to providence in Scripture is the term providebit in the Latin Vulgate translation of Genesis 22:8. Here, Abraham assures Isaac, his son, that the Lord will provide a sacrifice. Yet nowhere else does the linguistic term feature in either the Hebrew Bible or the Greek New Testament. The Bible, nevertheless, is replete with providential themes. These include the regularity of the natural world and the provision for creatures, which are celebrated in the creation stories and in the wisdom literature. The action of God is discerned also in the reunion of Joseph with his brothers down in Egypt, the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, in the coming of Cyrus to end the exile in Babylon, in the twists and turns of Israel's history, in the birth of Jesus when the time was right, and in the growth and development of the church. Then there is also the manner in which the world is ordered towards wisdom. This wisdom is acquired in the domestic and social settings of life, and it's not confined to Israel but seems to pervade every culture. All these examples represent different forms of divine action, which might suggest that we should not allow one single model to dominate our theology. Then there are the socio-political features of providence. These relate in part to the ways in which it is perceived to govern not merely the private and personal lives of individuals, but that of societies and nations. Furthermore, we will have to reckon with the ways in which, particularly from the Enlightenment onwards, nation-states and empires have tended to interpret their progress in history through the use of providential notions. So, for example, it was frequently claimed in the 19th century that God had ordained that the British Empire should spread to India in order that the Christian faith might be propagated there. The most significant challenge to traditional ideas of providence in the 19th century was probably Darwin's Origin of Species, first published in 1859. Most theologians were able to make their peace with Darwin, arguing that theology, that evolution rather, was perfectly compatible with creation. The evolving world was intended by God, and this was made possible by the original endowment of the cosmos with evolutionary capacities. Yet for many, the deeper challenges were those which surrounded the notion of providence. Could a world in which life forms appeared to evolve in a random and haphazard way be viewed as under the providential rule of God? At the very least, some rethinking of providence seemed to be required to accommodate the different account of the history of life that was gradually being revealed to 19th century scientists. A good example of this is Joseph Dice's painting of 1858, Pegwell Bay, which suggests a different worldview beginning to emerge amongst English intellectuals. The tide has gone out. Could this be the ebbing of faith? Fossils are being gathered on the seashore on the south coast of England, and they, together with the different rock strata, reveal something new about the long and mobile history of life on Earth. And in the sky above, you can't see Halley's Comet, but this is painted in order to show a change in the era that is now beginning to take place. Finally, the notion of providence is of deep existential and pastoral significance. Frequently, people look to providence to impose a shape upon their lives or to offer a sense of direction. Many of us work with inchoate and scarcely conscious notions of divine superintendence. Sometimes these verge on the superstitious and suddenly manifest themselves in times of crisis and uncertainty. Why is this happening to me? What have I done to deserve this? Much of the language of petitionary prayer presupposes a providence which can be invoked and extended, experienced and obeyed in all that happens to us. We have the well-known prayer for protection in the Book of Common Prayer. Dispose the way of thy servants, that among all the changes and chances of this mortal life, they may ever be defended by thy gracious and ready help. And even in more heterodox theological systems, such as deism and Unitarianism, a focus on divine providence persisted. Indeed, research into the lives of soldiers in the trenches of the Great War reveals that a belief in providence was often the last remaining vestige of faith. So on the basis of all this, we might venture the initial judgment that providence has traditionally been held as general. It signifies the way the world is made. It is also universal, neither occasional nor intermittent. It is pervasive in all societies and across cultures. Third, providence has been held to be particular. It determines the individual circumstances of people and communities. It is hidden, since it requires the discernment of faith, and even then is often inscrutable. And finally, providence is contested. The presence of evil, suffering, randomness, and misfortune create obstacles and crises for our more naive intuitions. In what follows this evening, I shall explore briefly the handling of providence at different stages in the history of Christian thought, in order to assess the problems and challenges that have arisen. First, the early church. In general, the terms providentia and the Greek pronoia are taken to denote divine foresight and provision. Foreknowledge is linked with a wider semantic field, including themes of rule, care, guidance, and purpose. Its linguistic prominence in Christian theology is indebted to the influence of ancient philosophy on the early church. This has also had a significant effect upon its material content. In ancient philosophy, accounts of providence were offered, partly in conscious opposition to Epicurean notions of chance. So, for example, in Plato's Laws, divine rule is affirmed against the view that the gods have no interest in human affairs. Later Stoic philosophy insisted upon the determination of everything by the operation of natural laws. These laws reflect a divine logos that infuses the cosmos and which works inexorably to fulfill a natural moral purpose. Consider the following remarks of Seneca. "This much I now say, that those things which you call hardships, which you call adversities and accursed, are in the first place for the good of the persons themselves to whom they come. In the second place, they are for the good of the whole human family, for which the gods have a greater concern than for single persons." Two features of this account are relevant in assessing its appropriation by Christian theology. First, it's an austere philosophy in which an impersonal moral purpose is fulfilled through everything that happens. Its tone may be reminiscent of sermons that many of us of a certain age will have heard in the past. Within this worldview, the sufferings that befall us are to be accepted as our fate, which, if we are willing to assent to them in the proper manner, will lead to an increase in virtue. And second, this account tends towards a determinism in the role that is assigned to human freedom and responsibility. Both Zeno and Chrysippus liken the human situation to that of a dog tied to a cart. The dog can willingly run alongside, keeping pace with the cart, or else it will be dragged. But either way, its destination remains the same. So on this account, every event must serve a purpose. Foreseen by the gods, the total system of causes governing the universe can thus be described as fate. These tendencies are undoubtedly present in the writers of the early church, who took on board much of what the Stoics had taught, but they're also adapted and sometimes checked and corrected. What emerges is not so much a clearly defined body of doctrine as a set of observations on providence which reflect the influence of those philosophical sources even as they adapt them. So, for example, Theophilus of Antioch can write towards the end of the 2nd century, "As if pagan and Christian teachers say much the same thing about providence. The Sibyl, then, and the other prophets, and the poets, and the philosophers have clearly taught concerning providence that God cares for us, not only for the living among us, but also for those that are dead." On the other hand, the scriptures provide clearer and deeper insights into the working of this providence. Justin Martyr sees not a fatal necessity nor an impersonal fate governing the affairs of human beings, but a God who has foreknowledge, oversight, and provision for individual men and women. Clement of Alexandria seems to split the difference by arguing at some length that providence is a widely accepted and unavoidable truth throughout the nations of the world, but that its finer details are understood only by the Christian philosophers. Two later examples, both from the early 5th century, illustrate further some of the tensions already present in the Church's teaching on providence. Theodoret of Cyrus, in a treatise dedicated to the subject, advances a series of rather engaging apologetic arguments for providential order. He says that the providence of God is apparent in the regulation of the planetary system, in the seasons of the year, in the harmony between species and environment, and even in the physiology of the human body. "Our buttocks," he says, "are happily arranged to provide a natural couch for sitting on the ground or on stone." Around the same time, however, Augustine's City of God offers a more somber and chastened reflection on the ways of providence, but nevertheless one that also affirms the rule of God throughout the cosmos. Augustine inveighs against all forms of astrological fatalism. The constellation of the stars, he argues, has no causal influence upon life on earth. Events here are not determined by remote events above the skies. Yet we can also affirm that God, through those secondary causes here on earth, including voluntary agents, brings about an overarching purpose. God's purpose is being worked out in relation to the two cities, the city of God and the city of the earth, and their respective company of angels. We might draw two lessons from all of this. The assumption that the Church shared providentialist beliefs with the Stoic philosophy of the ancient world led Church teaching in one direction. No doubt the struggle against theories of chance and fortune helped to forge this alliance. But it led to an overbearing determinism that leaned too far towards an acquiescence with the way things are. This ignored more biblical themes of struggle and resistance, these requiring a more dynamic approach to the subject. On the other hand, it's also clear that already in the early church, the attention to Scripture required some criticism and qualification of regnant theories of providence in the ancient world. Divine providence is purposive, particular, and parental, and should not be confused with either fate or fortune. Continuing this rapid historical tour, we come to the Christian West and to the accounts of Thomas Aquinas and John Calvin. Despite their differences, these belong to the same Latin tradition and reflect something like a consensus position that has long been held. Thomas Aquinas locates providence within the doctrine of God as one of the divine perfections. Providence belongs to God by virtue of divine omniscience and omnipotence. Nothing can happen that is not willed and known by God from all eternity. Since each thing owes its existence to God, its final end is bound to be directed by God. Aquinas employs here the model of God as artist. Since God's knowledge is related to things like that of an artist to works of art, it must be that all things are set under God's ordering. Though evils may conflict with the nature of some particular thing, these contribute to the overall end of nature. Were all evils to be denied entrance, many good things would be lacking in the world. There would not be life for the lion, were there no animals for its prey, and there would be no patience of martyrs, were there no persecution by tyrants. A distinction between primary and secondary causality becomes crucial here in order to avoid the implication that God is the author of evil and sin. The secondary causes which govern contingent entities are related to the primary cause of God's will, but it is the former that carry responsibility for the imperfections of the world. So there is here a double agency attaching to each single event. The primary will of God is mediated or enacted through the secondary causes within creation. On the subject of freedom, Aquinas stresses how divine agency guarantees rather than threatens our contingent creaturely freedoms. God does not so much act upon human persons, so causing them to act in the ways they do, but instead God makes persons to be what they are, thus enabling them to be free. So again, divine and creaturely agency belong to different orders. These are complementary and non-competitive. Similar justification of prayer is offered by Aquinas. He argues that divine providence has ordered the world in such a way that the will of God is sometimes made effective through the agency of human prayer. John Calvin and the post-Reformation tradition continue this theology of providence, albeit in a different existential key. Once the world is created, Calvin argues that God's providence is its inevitable corollary. He writes, from the conviction that it is the teaching of Scripture that everything is ordained by God, behind what appears to us uncertain and confused, there lies the steady and immutable will of God. The providence of God employs creaturely means for the fulfillment of the divine will. As with Aquinas, so Calvin is careful to note that the attribution of all events to God's will does not entail that God is the cause of sin and evil. These are to be assigned to creaturely agencies which carry the sole responsibility for wrongdoing. The rays of the sun, he says, may cause the corpse to putrefy, but the stink is to be attributed to the corpse and not to the sun. Here again, the distinction between primary causality and secondary causality is crucial. Calvin insists that the will of God governs every single event in the cosmos. Anything else would render God idle, disengaged, or lacking a definite purpose and appropriate control of the created order. These alternatives are pagan notions that have to be excluded in maintaining a faithful account of the God of the Bible. This yielded a doctrine of providence that was typically reformed, yet Calvin believed himself merely to be stating what had already been taught by the Catholic Church. The comprehensive nature of God's ever-watchful rule informs Calvin's account, and it promotes a particular type of piety. Tribulations are sent to chastise or steel us in the ways of discipleship. These elicit an attitude of trust that nothing can happen by fortune or chance, for everything is under the paternal care of God. Although he explicitly steers a course between Epicureanism and Stoicism in outlining his theology of providence, Calvin's notion of God foreordaining in meticulous detail the history of the world has resulted in his theology being more closely associated with Stoic fatalism. In particular, his insistence that divine forewilling is logically prior to divine foreknowledge has resulted in his theology of providence being placed in close proximity with his strong doctrine of predestination. This has often troubled Calvin's critics, even from his own days in Geneva onwards, who fear the reintroduction of a random fatalism into Christian theology. We have also to reckon with a strong pastoral dimension to this doctrine as it emerges in the Reformed tradition. A stress on divine providence was intended to facilitate a sense of assurance, guidance, and direction in face of unexpected sickness, misfortune, or political uncertainty. No doubt this was particularly resonant with Protestant refugees arriving in Geneva, and with beleaguered Reformed churches elsewhere in Europe. This is evident in their confessions and catechisms, and in the ways in which the idea of providence governed expressions of personal and political identity. A related practical upshot of the Calvinist doctrine is a sense of confidence and trust, which derive from the knowledge that the future is secured by God no matter what happens. Yet the downside of this teaching is that it leads to an account of providence in which too much is attributed to a positive divine will. Too much is attributed to divine determinism, as if every single event must positively be willed by God. This criticism exercised a powerful hold in later critics, and it became a source of complaint by Karl Barth in his radical revision of the Reformed doctrine of providence in the mid-20th century. Charles Taylor has drawn attention to what he calls the anthropocentric turn in providentialist thinking during the 18th century. Calvin had seen the function of providence as leading us into a truer obedience and a glorifying of God in the Christian life. But now it is assumed that what providence offers us is largely our own happiness, if only we abide by the dictates of our moral sense. At the same time, the service of God is not to be rendered in the spiritual life of cloistered worship, intense devotion, or fervent prayer, so much as in the fulfilling of our duties to God, self, and neighbour. The hand of providence is now more clearly evinced in worldly pursuits. The secular realm has its own laws. These can be discovered by the practice of the natural sciences. Economic and political activity can similarly be pursued successfully. Progress in human affairs under divine rule is increasingly possible. The world has its own harmony, order, and structure, which, when properly discerned, will lead to human flourishing. This was applied not only to nature, but also to secular history and economics. In his essay Idea for a Universal History with a Cosmopolitan Aim, Kant, in the late 18th century, offers a philosophical account of history in which the base and selfish aims of human beings and society bring about a rational political constitution in which these are overruled. The exhausting and destructive effects of conflict eventually persuade human persons of the worth of a better political order. Through suffering and the ill effects of our unsociable sociability, we come to acknowledge and to assent to the rule of law. Even the just political state will find itself in conflict with rival states in the international arena. But through competition and wars, these will lead in time to the establishment of a more just cosmopolitan order. For Kant and other Enlightenment thinkers, the traumas of war and the benefits of trade will tend to ensure that through selfish means a greater common good will naturally emerge in the life of nations. His account of organic development appears indebted to earlier Stoic notions of a natural law unfolding everywhere in the cosmos. This order manifests itself through the actions of individual agents, which from a more particular perspective appear base and irrational. Genevieve Lloyd, in her recent commentary, regards Kant's vision of world history as a secularized version of Augustine's providential account of the city of God. The principal difference is that the earthly city is now the exclusive focus of Kant's attention. It is the only arena in which providence is to be manifested. This providence, moreover, is a result of the outworking of natural laws. Whether Kant viewed this cosmopolitan ideal as an imminent historical probability or a more regulative idea is not entirely clear, but the redirection of the idea of providence to international relations governed by organic processes of development is now evident. In general, Kant's philosophy of history seems to support some form of European expansionism. To his credit, he deplores conquest by force, while his stress on the respect to be accorded each human person provides a powerful argument against enslavement. But at other times, he maintains a troubling silence on the matter of slavery, despite having the resources to attack it. And in his writings on race, Kant assumes that in some racial groups, the development of human potential has been greater than in others. This results in a privileging of white Europeans, which is further narrowed to developments within Europe itself. What is significant in this context is the implicit notion that providence seems to have ordained the hegemony of a particular type of civilization in Kant, in which distinctive human capacities have been developed. The danger in this providential construction of political events and systems is manifold. The exceptionalism that often accompanies forms of civil religion, and not only in large nations and empires, can have the effect of overriding the competing claims of other nations and political groups when these clash, or of threatening the position of those who do not fulfill the criteria of national identity. Yet there is little New Testament warrant for concluding that the Christian faith might be advanced by the peculiar singling out of one nation state, race, or empire as its vehicle. Many of the arguments advanced in favor of imperial expansion from the 16th century onwards revolve around this notion that Europeans served a divinely ordained purpose by colonizing other parts of the world. One might seek to overcome this sort of particularism and its attendant partiality by viewing the whole of history as moving forward under some divine influence, not simply one nation, but all the nations of the earth together. This would be done in such a way that each of its constituent parts makes a contribution to the whole, so that none is really selected at the expense of the other. The weak and the strong, the righteous and the unrighteous, the successful and the unlucky would all be gathered into a single movement that collectively leads to the realization of some overarching scheme. It is, of course, in Hegel's philosophy of history that we find this impulse. Here it is the global function of providence that is set out. God's Spirit directs the particular events and actors of history with what Hegel calls an absolute cunning. Each contributes in some way to an emergent whole which cannot be understood except, if at all, with the benefit of hindsight. It is not that this is a meaning imposed deterministically in a top-down manner. By contrast, it is a pattern that emerges on the slaughter bench of history through the evils, self-interest, and violence of human affairs. Hegel employs a fabric metaphor by which the interweaving of the idea of God with the passions of history brings about a realization of divine consciousness and human freedom. Although there are similarities here with Kant's providentialism, Hegel is more cautious in one important respect. Progress in history is discernible only with the benefit of hindsight. It is backward rather than forward-looking. Only in retrospect can we discern a meaning amidst the historical processes we inhabit. So he writes famously, "When philosophy paints its grey on grey, then has a shape of life grown old. By philosophy's grey on grey, it cannot be rejuvenated, but only understood. The owl of Minerva, that ancient symbol of wisdom, spreads its wings only with the falling of the dusk." The problem with this more universal philosophy of history, however, is that despite its grandeur and subtlety, there is an apparent lack of a particular providence that offers some account of parental care for each individual person. To some, this notion is no doubt naive. It's a consoling device that doesn't survive robust criticism. But nevertheless, it seems pretty close to the core of Jesus' teaching, and a good deal of what the Christian tradition has wanted to maintain about God and providence in relation to individual creatures. And in any case, claims for a providential pattern which governs the whole rather than the individual parts can too easily lead to political claims which justify the means by reference to the end. In his book Politics as Religion, Emilio Gentili, an Italian political philosopher, shows how many of the political entities that have emerged in modern times have tended to appropriate religious symbols, myths, and rituals drawn from older faith traditions. This is true particularly of fascism, communism, and Nazism, but also of the civil religion that continues to manifest itself in our Western democracies. Within the rhetoric of these political regimes, there were powerful but problematic claims to be the vehicles in world history of divine providence. This is apparent in the manner in which a wide variety of political movements have functioned in a quasi-religious manner, seeking to mobilize the masses by the use of religious rhetoric and ideology, particularly the concepts of providence. Something of this is echoed in Jefferson's inaugural addresses, and of the way subsequently that American history has woven into a discourse that expressed a sense of divine providence through a mission to the rest of the world, a testimony to political freedom and the heroic sacrifice of the war dead. National acts of thanksgiving for the general and special mercies of the Creator were thus elicited. There is no doubt that such notions can contribute to a sense of civic cohesion and corporate identity. It's hard, I guess, to imagine a nation without its myths, heroes, sense of purpose, and defining historic moments. And it would be a mistake to evacuate the political sphere of any religious significance, as if this were simply a matter of private piety. Nevertheless, the dangers of misappropriation, exceptionalism, and xenophobia are apparent from surveys of how the concept of providence has functioned politically, both in domestic and foreign policy, particularly in the 19th and 20th centuries. The other direction in which the theology of providence developed, particularly from the 17th century onwards, was inwards in a psychological direction. Its emergence as a political theology was also matched by its spiritual development in the lives of individual Christian men and women. Divine guidance and direction were perceived by the incidental details of individual lives, as if these provided a coded message from above. Much Protestant literature proceeded along these lines, with attention devoted to the inner spiritual development and personal biographies of the faithful. It's significant that spiritual diaries flourished in the 17th century, as Alexandra Walsham has noted in her study of providentialism in Puritan England. Here, the hand of God is detected in everything that happens, so that some pattern must be discerned or interpreted in our individual lives. Walsham writes that nowhere is the Puritan propensity for detecting the finger of God in the most mundane events more vividly exhibited than in their journals and diaries, letters, autobiographies, and private memorabilia. Ralph Josselyn, for instance, saw divine providence at work in a simple bee sting he suffered on the 5th of September 1644, and in the white pus which seeped from his navel one November day in 1649. John Winthrop, first governor of the colony of Massachusetts, acknowledged providence in the timely discovery of a spider in the family porridge bowl on the 15th of December 1610. And just one of the remarkable providences vouchsafed to the Ipswich apprentice and New England immigrant John Dane was his narrow escape from the clutches of a buxom prostitute who thrust herself upon him in an inn where he lodged around 1629. He wrote, "O wonderful, unspeakable, unsearchable mercies of a God that taketh care of us when we take no care of ourselves." His little notebook was destined to become a precious family heirloom. Perhaps rather better is this plaque that is found in an early 17th century Reformed church in Burnt Island, Scotland. It illustrates the extent to which local fishermen lived in need of divine protection from a climate that was frequently hostile and always unpredictable. And yet they found in their climate the sustaining of their way of life, linking this with the providence of God. It's easy to understand the ways in which people sought the reassurance that could arise from detecting the hand of providence upon their life circumstances. In times of political upheaval, ecclesiastical uncertainty, and plague, the future seemed hazardous. Before departing for North America, emigrants wanted to be sure that they were following the steer given them by the hand of Providence. And in their time in the New World, they constantly sought assurance that they remained under God's protection and blessing. This was done again by seeking to discern the signs of favor or displeasure in the fluctuating circumstances of their personal lives. My colleague, Susan Hardman Moore, has drawn attention to the memoirs of Susanna Bell. These were dictated from her deathbed, and they provide a graphic and moving account of how she sought to serve God and her family by discerning the tokens of providence in her life. She recalls how the presence of one small child and the anticipated arrival of another were signs that God did not wish her to emigrate. But the subsequent death of her child then led her instead to interpret this as another sign from God that she should now embark upon the journey to New England. And so, as an expectant mother, she crossed the Atlantic in 1634, only to return later. Reading the diaries and other testimonies of those who sought to discern the hand of Providence in the microscopic details of their lives, we become aware of the effect that doctrine can have in the lives of those who receive it on good faith. Much of this is moving and occasionally profound, although at times we are left feeling that it could readily become oppressive, self-serving, indulgent, and even superstitious. One problem with this psychologizing approach is that it imposes too tight a fit between creaturely contingency and divine directives, as if everything has a secret purpose and is not what it appears to be in natural terms. In such a worldview, there is no space for misfortune, bad luck, and randomness. These are only ciphers concealing some intentional purpose of a higher agency. This can lead to some quite frivolous speculation or crushing disappointment and disillusion when things suddenly go wrong for us. Why is God doing this to me when I have tried to lead a faithful and upright life? Jesus remarks about the fate of those who were crushed by the Tower of Siloam, and his reflection on the man born blind suggests that there is no direct divine correlation between the merits of our actions and the fate we suffer. Each event may provide a fresh opportunity for serving God or deepening faith, but it's important to distinguish this idea from the more Stoic claim that these events are directly visited upon us to exercise some hidden blueprint. You might think that these examples from 17th century Puritanism are rather quaint and naive. We now know better and act more rationally, but do we? Consider the ways in which human beings appear incurably superstitious today. Notions that we can manipulate God or some pagan surrogate, such as fate, destiny, or fortune, continue to abound, particularly in those activities that are inherently unpredictable, simply because of their complexity, or because we lack any adequate knowledge of causal processes, or because of the ways in which outcomes are finely balanced. We know from research that sports personalities are inherently superstitious and religious, sometimes because this is thought to give them a competitive advantage. Consider how many substitutes cross themselves before entering the field of play, or prayers that are invoked during the team huddle prior to kickoff, or thanks offered after a goal, a touchdown, or final victory. Some golfers will silently pray before making a crucial shot, as if God was likely to reward them for their piety, thus presumably punishing an opponent who plays without similar invocation. The story is told of the famous baseball catcher Yogi Berra, who waited behind an incoming hitter. When his opponent proceeded to cross himself before receiving the pitch, Berra quietly said to him, "Why don't you just let God enjoy the game?" The underlying point is that God doesn't do deals with us, at least not in this way. And this is sometimes a hard teaching to learn in more important matters than the outcome of a ball game. So to conclude, there are two lessons from this brief survey of the history of providence, which will carry us into tomorrow's lecture. One is just how deep-seated, pervasive, and indispensable the idea of providence has become. Even in post-Christian settings, it does not disappear, but tends to be refracted in significant ways. But a second moral is that the story is punctuated with problems, mistakes, and pitfalls. We have observed the ready appropriation of Stoicism in the early church, the overbearing determinism of the classical doctrine in the Latin West, the ideological appropriation of providence by imperial projects, and the overdetermination of contingent events in the way in which these were spiritually interpreted, especially by the Protestant faithful. Some serious repair work is therefore required if we are to have a chastened and serviceable account of providence which can be both adequate and plausible. I'll try to speak about this more challenging task tomorrow, but for the moment I thank you for your attention and I look forward to your questions and comments. Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to join in saying thank you to Professor Ferguson. He doesn't need me up here at the mic to guide the question period. He's easily as experienced at that as any of us here are. So I think what I'll do is I will simply leave you the mic, and I shall sit over there where the light is not shining in my eyes and that I can see hands, all right? So. When you are pointed at or otherwise encouraged to speak, please do speak loudly enough for everyone to hear. We have a mic at the back there, right? You'll be able to speak into that. That's great. And do eventually find your way to a question, or I will eventually find my way to another questioner. Thank you.
I wanted to thank you very much for the lecture, Professor Ferguson, and just ask if you could address the relationship between covenant and providence, because Protestants obviously felt a great covenantal understanding of religion, which they take from the Hebrew scripture, perhaps, and also aspects of the Christian gospel, but they emphasized covenant. There was an emphasis on covenant, and I just thought that the two concepts are related. I could be wrong.
No, I think you're right. They are related, particularly in the way in which providence developed in political contexts. The notion of covenant became adapted in political societies that were particularly influenced by Protestantism. And it could be used to express notions of political exceptionism. So, for example, To give you a case with which I am more familiar, in 17th century Scotland, there is the view that Scotland is a covenanted nation. And this brings about the idea of divine exceptionalism, that Scotland is destined to be the new Israel in the mediation of God's purposes for other nations and for the world generally. So the notion of covenant does develop alongside providential notions, particularly in the political appropriation of these ideas. But I think the same problems attach to the development of covenant, particularly the idea of a political exceptionism. There's only one Israel in the Hebrew Bible, and there is no sense, I think, that other nations could in the dispensation of the church see themselves as peculiarly covenanted over and above rival nations. So I think the use of the covenant concept is also one that's misappropriated in the development of the tradition in these political contexts.
You presented a survey of various different forms of providence down through the centuries, and I'm wondering whether there is any common threads between these whereby people were felt themselves justified in making these claims about an otherwise about the intentions of an otherwise inscrutable God, whether there's some sort of common theme that gave them the confidence to interpret the contingent events that was happening in their lives in these ways.
I'm not sure that there is. I mean, there is clearly, in almost all cases, a return to the language and stories of Scripture to support many of these claims. Are there other common themes? I'm less sure of that. I mean, there's a familiarity with the older Christian tradition, particularly in the 18th and 19th centuries, and people draw upon providential notions that come at least from Augustine, and they reappropriate these in more secular contexts. But I'm not sure whether there are other common themes. Sometimes these are used by people who see themselves as in control of history, but at other times they're powerful themes to articulate the plight of people who find themselves oppressed and on the underside of history. So they're used in different ways by different groups in different circumstances. Did you have something else in mind in your question? I may not have picked you up properly.
The question might have been, if I can return to the point you made about the scriptures, was it that they saw these things or God's hand at play in the scriptures in the lives of believers and then felt justified to do that or interpret in the same way in their own lives so that they could imagine themselves, as you said, as a new Israel, quite literally seeing their own lives as an extension of the stories of the holy texts.
I think that certainly happens in the Reformed tradition, with its particular attention to the Hebrew scriptures and the use of many stories, particularly from the history of Israel. These are well known, they're recounted and recited. These are people that read the Bible, that memorized it, that knew it inside out. So they had these resources at their fingertips and were able to draw upon them in the articulation of their own life stories as under the hand of providence. So that's certainly a recurrent theme in the literature of the 17th and 18th centuries, I would say. It's in that sense, it's very much a tradition that's dependent upon texts rather than artifacts. It's a point that Alexandra Walsham makes.
Hi, thank you very much. In your discussion this evening, there was a lot of you used words like parental and personal. And I wondered, is there any development of impersonal providentiality, a kind of a causality that is not agential in the sense of being a person's intention, or is that something that's not explored?
I think that's certainly there in the more anthropocentric forms of providentialism that flourish in the modern period after the Enlightenment. Providence is seen there not so much in particular interpositions of the divine and human nature and history, but rather in the grain of events, in the general direction of the world, whether we're talking about the motions of the planets or the laws of economics or the direction of history. The providence that governs these is, I think, a more impersonal providence than the kind of providence that governs the diaries of Puritans in the 17th century. So that is part of the shift or the inflection, if you like, in theories of providence that we find in the modern period. So I think, you know, your point about a transition from more personal to impersonal notions might be appropriate in that setting. And of course, you know, as I tried to say, what we have in Kant is in many ways a return to more Stoic impersonal notions of direction, of history being governed by particular laws that you know, lead to our greater well-being or to the benefit of nations.
Thank you very much for your lecture. My question concerns the distinction between Stoicism and the early church or afterwards. For the Stoics, for instance, for Epictetus, he says there are no more robbers or thieves. Everything is indifferent, so we should not judge something as bad or evil. But at the same time, there is no forgiveness to happen because we are never insulted. We just have to consider that they are ignorant and that they give their assent to a false proposition which considers that it is good or bad, while in fact it's indifferent because it's not under our control. And so I was wondering when the fathers of the church take their distance from it. And I also was wondering if you see an influence of the problem of evil as something that, from the point of view of the essence, we cannot explain what it is, but at the same time, we should maintain the judgment on evil. So I was thinking, for instance, of your example of Aquinas. The tyrant is still a tyrant for Aquinas, even though we consider that from every bad thing, God can do something good. And so I was wondering about this distinction, when does it happen and how you see it? Mm-hmm. So from the neutral aspect of things to this switched where from an existential point of view, nonetheless, an injustice is an injustice, even though we can consider that from this injustice something greater can follow.
I think there's some very interesting historical questions in what you say, and I'm not sure exactly what the answers are, but my impression is that what we have in the early church is not so much a clearly defined body of doctrine, which of course we get in the Middle Ages and at the Reformation, but rather a series of occasional explorations of the idea of providence, which draw upon sources from ancient philosophy, particularly the Stoics. In some ways, they agree with what the Stoics are saying, and they use arguments from the Stoics against those who would insist upon chance or fortune as being regulative. But there are also signs that Christian writers want to adapt and check some of the ideas of the Stoics at the same time. And I don't know that it's any more coherent than that, that there isn't a single body of teaching that clearly emerges from the first few centuries. What is more significant in relation to the treatment of evil is the writings of Augustine, who I think sets out the positions that are then developed and codified in the Middle Ages and at the Reformation. So I would see, particularly with respect to the way in which the problem of suffering and evil is handled, the influence of Augustine as being decisive, at least in the Latin West. Another interesting historical question is whether there's a rather different approach to providence in the East, in the Greek East, and that there may, I think, be an approach that is rather less deterministic in the Greek fathers as opposed to the Latin fathers, as we say. That might be something I'll say more about tomorrow. The permission, the distinction between divine willing and permission is more clearly marked in the Eastern tradition than it is in the Latin West.
I'm interested in the cases where whether or not providence is on your side is contended over, and one, whether there's another story to do with providence and religious freedom. I'm from New England, and if you say to most residents of New England providence, they think Rhode Island. But that also brings with it the history of being kicked out of Puritan Massachusetts Bay Colony, seeking religious freedom. I don't know enough about the history of naming the city Providence, whether that goes with that exile from Massachusetts Bay Colony or not, but it certainly seems to be associated in some way with a choice that the freedom we have to practice our religion is an act of providence, even though the Puritans would be saying providence is ours. So the question is, any thoughts you have about the alignment of providence and religious freedom?
It's certainly the case that many people in the 16th and 17th centuries believe that a significant mark of divine providence was the suffering and persecution that they were undergoing. So, I mean, it's a feature of some of the confessions of the 16th century that the righteous have a much harder life than the unrighteous. It's almost a complete inversion of modern piety, which offers health and prosperity to the righteous. It's the other way around for many people in the circumstances of the 16th century. Providence and religious freedom. I need to think more about that, but I'm pretty sure that there's quite a lot in the writing of say John Cotton about the way in which it is the divine vocation, destiny of people who have emigrated to New England to be a witness to religious freedom and toleration as ordained by God and as being more faithful to Scripture than those systems that they were seeking to replace, to depart from in the old world. So I think that one could probably see some link, at least a dotted line, between providence and religious freedom in the writings of Cotton and others, but I can't put my hand on any chapter and verse.
One or two more, I think. Yes,
sir. I was just interested in your conception of the secularized understandings of providence. I wonder if you'd be able to spell out some of the characteristics of such visions of the secular, and whether one of them might be a tension with the religious, once a concept of providence has infiltrated the secular, does it end up creating a tension between that conception of the secular and religious-based understandings of providence?
Yes, my thesis is that providence doesn't disappear in the secular, but is refracted in quite interesting ways. And once you get below the surface, you see some quite clear evidences for providentialist thinking being maintained, certainly in the philosophers of the Enlightenment, and in much of what we find in the 19th century. Saint-Simon said in his deathbed, apparently, that religion never goes away from the modern world. It simply gets displaced and reappears in other contexts. And you know, I think that's what happens in many modern ideologies. Even in fairly secular societies, the language of providence still presents itself, particularly in times of crisis, which seems to me requires some kind of commentary or analysis. I'm not sure that I heard everything you said, or whether there was more to your question than I've been able to answer. Yeah.
Could I press the question a little bit further? If the Enlightenment saw the emergence of a kind of cult of progress, as some have referred to it, but that is a secularized notion of the doctrine of providence that supported that. Is it possible for society to continue to believe in, perhaps not steady, but nevertheless overall progress, without some underlying theology to support it? Is it a self-sustaining idea once the older theological foundations are abandoned?
I think I probably get two kinds of answers to that. One is that secular progress may be a dangerous myth, and it's one that we need to beware of. The idea that progress is inevitable and indefinite, that is quite a deeply ingrained assumption that many of us have. But I'm not sure that it's justified. And a second would be that while, you know, in the traditions of Christian theology, there is the possibility of some forms of progress at some times in history, these are nevertheless occasional and intermittent and not always guaranteed or inevitable. So there are at best signs of divine providence in secular history, as opposed to any kind of philosophy of secular history which sees it as an unrolling of an inexorable progression upwards into the future.
Well, yes, one last question from Mr. Thomas.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. I enjoyed it greatly. My question is more of a historical nature, I suppose, although it might have implications for the development of a contemporary theology of providence. You've painted the Christian West rather monochromatically, calling on Augustine and Calvin, but I wonder if that particular access is the only one. I wonder, for example, about Boethius and Aquinas. Doesn't that represent a somewhat different axis? Because it seems to me, for example, Boethius imports the doctrine of eternity to allow for a universe of chance, to allow for the possibility of free, contingent events occurring within a universe which is nonetheless overseen by God. And it seems to me that there's the same kind of thing going on in Aquinas in his talk of providence. that it's entirely possible to conceive of the world in which we live as being under God's rule, God's providence, but nonetheless one in which free, contingent, and hence chance events can occur.
I think there are variations upon a theme in that Latin tradition. And Aquinas, for example, works quite hard to give greater weight to human freedom than he fears might be the case in some of the Augustinian tradition. So there are particular and differing points of emphasis in the tradition. But I still think that the Latin tradition is quite monolithic in important respects, particularly with respect to double agency and the use of primary and secondary causality. So if you press the question of Boethius, Aquinas, Calvin, and all the rest, why this is happening, the ultimate answer will be because God wills it from all eternity. And that gets played out in the language of double agency and the distinction between primary and secondary causes, albeit in different ways. And many of these theologians were you know, very persuaded in their own minds that human freedom was a reality and indeed was guaranteed by the divine will. But I think the way it gets worked out is quite similar right through that Latin tradition. And to that extent, you know, I'm inclined to group Aquinas and Calvin together as exponents of a single classical view that is articulated in the Latin West. But I'm open to challenge, of course, and if Boethius says something very different, then I'll go back and have a look at him. But I you know, again, make the point that if you press the why question hard enough, it comes down to the will of God from all eternity. And what, from one perspective, appears to be chance or sort of random outcomes is in another sense determined.
Is that what you believe?
Is that what I believe? Yeah. Personally, no.
Well, we've plenty of unfinished business here, which we will carry on to tomorrow night. Whether we will find out what Professor Ferguson believes personally or not, I can't say. I can't say that there was a major dispute at the University of Paris in the 13th century over the question of determinism, which I think the outcome of that debate not only opened up some of the possibilities of modern science, but also modern ways of thinking about the human being and about human culture. And I have no doubt that tomorrow afternoon, whether we get back to the 13th century or not, we're going to have a chance with Professor Ferguson to explore some of the alternative ways of looking at this that he has in mind for us to consider. Meanwhile, the Habs are going to step on the ice soon. Josh Georges is sure to cross himself as he comes out of the gate, and God wants to enjoy the game, but we're going to enjoy wine and cheese. So please join me in thanking Professor Ferguson.